You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
February 12th, I'm Scott Baba. A shutdown at the Department of Homeland Security looms as congressional budget talks stall over ICE restrictions. The Environmental Protection Agency rescinds a major landmark climate finding, potentially undoing decades of emissions rules. Secretary Chair Paul Atkins is grilled on banking deregulation, crypto oversight before Senate panel. And over a year after the Eden fire ravaged Los Angeles, California launches a civil rights probe into the emergency response. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. A shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security appeared likely today as lawmakers prepared to leave Washington for a 10-day break, and talks between Democrats and the White House stalled over new limits on immigration enforcement. Speaking today after the Senate rejected a bill to fund the department, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York said the most recent White House offer, which was not made public, did not include sufficient curbs on ICE.
Today's strong vote was a shot across the bow to Republicans. Democrats will not support a blank check for chaos. This vote today asked a simple question. Will you rein in ICE's abuses, or will you vote to extend the chaos? Republicans chose chaos, and the Democrats, we refused.
The White House and Democrats have traded offers in recent days. Democrats are demanding restrictions on U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and other DHS agencies, including requiring officers to show identification, a new code of conduct for those agencies, tightening use of force policies, and mandating judicial warrants before entering private property. The push follows two fatal shootings last month involving federal officers. President Donald Trump said Democratic proposals would be, quote, very, very hard to approve. But Schumer said Americans want accountability.
The American people are tired. They're tired of seeing these horrific videos. They turn your stomach. And 90% of Americans say they've seen them. The videos of Americans beaten, snatched off the streets, treated like they have no rights. These videos are reminiscent of what you see in dictatorships. The Americans are tired of masked agents conducting warrantless operations in their communities, secret police. They're tired of chaos, secrecy, and zero accountability. That is not what law and order looks like.
Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune said a shutdown appeared likely. If no deal is reached, immigration enforcement would largely continue, backed by billions approved last year. But other DHS agencies, including FEMA, TSA, and the Coast Guard, could face mounting strain if the shutdown drags on. Meanwhile, before the vote, a Minnesota delegation was in Washington, D.C. today demanding that Congress vote no on the funding for immigration enforcement. Educators were among those sharing their experiences under Operation Metro Surge. Mike Moen reports.
The White House border czar says the large-scale immigration and customs enforcement operation, which has fueled continuous public outcry, will conclude. The delegation says that shouldn't be the only move. It doesn't want any more money going to agencies overseeing ICE activity. Quentin Waltoon Ochama teaches at Maxfield Elementary in St. Paul, and he made the trip, hoping lawmakers hear more stories about agents targeting places like school bus stops, resulting in vulnerable students staying home. He says the effects are showing up in the classroom for students still able to attend, with these young kids consistently asking about ICE.
And that's a tough conversation to have with anybody, but particularly 5- and 6-year-olds. A lot of time I'm their first teacher in a formal role. It's awful.
He says social bonds are formed by students during the school year, and seeing classmates suddenly go into hiding or detained with their families is likely to leave a lasting impression. Delegation members met with lawmakers and also held a news conference on Capitol grounds. On Tuesday, administration officials defended the operation during an oversight hearing ahead of a key vote late this week on Department of Homeland Security funding. The Columbia Heights Public School District has often been in the spotlight after several students were detained and sent to facilities out of state, including 5-year-old Liam Ramos. Valley View Elementary teacher Peg Nelson says the district has been terrorized by ICE while forcing staff to overhaul routine operations so that families in hiding receive basic needs.
Our school has literally become a food shelf, so our hallways are floor to ceiling, filled with food. There's 2 refrigerators in the middle of our hallway. So it just looks and feels completely different, and that's not normal.
She says, like what happened with COVID, there are fears students forced to switch to online learning will suffer academically. But Nelson warns the social and emotional impact will extend even further. During Tuesday's hearing, Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons emphasized the administration's push to target violent offenders.
We are seizing fentanyl before it kills our children, and dismantling the networks that poison our communities.
But educators say agency leaders can't be trusted and are ignoring the terror seen in schools. Mandy Jung is a middle school teacher in St. Paul, and she says she spent $4,000 of her own money to help affected families cover rent. She worries about the trust that will be lost for kids who no longer feel welcome in America. She adds it feels absurd at times trying to carry on with the day's lesson plans.
We're doing photosynthesis right now, and to ask kids to focus on the beautiful things that make our earth while they're seeing so much hatred and ugliness and experiencing so much fear is just an extremely strange dichotomy.
This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
The Trump administration is calling a halt to the immigration crackdown in Minnesota. The operation, focused in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, flared up after the killings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy by federal officers. The announcement of the end of the operation was made by Border Czar Tom Homan, who took over the operation after the killings. Christopher Martinez reports.
White House Border Czar Tom Homan announced the end of Operation Metro Surge at a news conference in Minneapolis.
We've had great success with this operation, and we're leaving Minnesota safer. The surge is leaving Minnesota safer, Minneapolis safer, because of the cooperation we got with the counties and the state and local law enforcement responding to our needs. I'll say it again. It's less of a sanctuary state for criminals.
The Minnesota operation was the largest immigration enforcement action ever, resulting in more than 4,000 arrests, according to Homan. He rejected criticisms over ICE practices, saying there have been no arrests in churches, hospitals, or elementary schools. Homan had announced last week that 700 federal officials would leave Minnesota immediately, leaving 2,000. He says the drawdown now will continue next week, and he will stay to oversee it. He also says Quick Response Forces, or QRFs, will also stay for now.
But there will be some security teams staying here, the QRFs, until we're assured that those agitators incidents either stay low or further decline. I'm not going to remove everybody out of the safety of officers, but like I said, and Operation Metro Surge is ending. And in the next week, we're going to deploy the officers here on detail back to the home stations or other areas of the country are needed.
Homan frames the end of the operation as a success made possible by cooperation from local officials. But those local officials tell a more complicated story. At a congressional hearing on ICE Thursday, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison told senators there has been no cooperation on the killings of Preddy and Good.
This situation, when we were told you can't have access to the evidence, to the crime scene, that was highly unusual and surprising to us. And so we're hoping that we can gain cooperation, perhaps in the Preddy matter. But we've been advised that the Good matter is there, the feds are not investigating it, and we still haven't received any access to the evidence that is involved in that case. So it's an unusual, strange situation, but we're with good faith, hoping that things will change.
Later, a reporter asked Ellison whether he trusts the feds to follow through on the drawdown.
I guess we're in a, I certainly hope so, right? I mean, Operation Metro Search has really hurt Minnesota. And so I'm very hopeful that it's true, but I'm going to have to see what people on the ground are telling me before I would accept that it's in fact the case.
Back in Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz shared mixed feelings about Homan's announcement. He spoke at a news conference in St. Paul.
We are cautiously optimistic, as we've said, and that this surge of untrained, aggressive federal agents are going to leave Minnesota. And I guess they'll go wherever they're going to go. But the fact of the matter is, they left us with deep damage, generational trauma. They left us with economic ruin in some cases. They left us with many unanswered questions.
The end of the Minnesota surge comes as lawmakers debate funding for the Department of Homeland Security, with Democrats holding out for reforms to ICE practices. Democratic senators are also expressing skepticism over the end of the Minnesota surge. Senator Richard Blumenthal is a Democrat from Connecticut.
The reduction in the numbers of agents in Minneapolis, the so-called elimination of the surge, in no way changes the tactics which the American people are demanding be reformed. The violence and brutality, including killing people, has to be totally stopped. And the American people are demanding fundamental and far-reaching reforms that we are insisting be a condition of funding for DHS.
Top House Democrats sounded a similar message at an informal hearing on ICE and accountability. Democrat Catherine Clark of Massachusetts is the House Minority Whip.
Kristi Noem needs to go. Stephen Miller needs to go. Federal agents need to get back to their core mission and abide by the same rules, the same laws, the same Constitution as any other law enforcement officer. And this needs to happen today. No more delays, no more CRs, no more state-sanctioned terror.
As for Minnesota, Governor Walz says the state is focusing on recovery. State Attorney General Ellison says he's never been more proud to be a Minnesotan.
I'm so proud of the people who helped their neighbors, who stood up for their First Amendment rights, some of which was criticized in here. I hope it's over, and now it's the time to heal and put things back together again, and I have every confidence that we will do that.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
A traditionally bipartisan meeting of the National Governors Association at the White House is back on after invitations were extended to all governors. This following an initial round of invitations that did not include any Democratic governors. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, a Republican and NGA co-chair, told members yesterday that President Donald Trump had invited all 55 governors from the states and territories to next week's business breakfast, calling earlier exclusions a scheduling misunderstanding. The apparent reversal comes after Stitt told NGA members Monday that the organization would no longer facilitate the White House meeting, citing the decision to only invite Republicans and to further exclude from a White House dinner two governors who have publicly quarreled with Trump, Maryland's Wes Moore, who co-chairs the NGA with Stitt, and Colorado's Jared Polis. However, Trump posting on True Social yesterday evening claimed Stitt mischaracterized the situation and said he had only ever excluded Moore and Polis, who he said were, quote, not worthy of attending. Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Paul Atkins today testified before the Senate Banking Committee. He faced questions about banking deregulation and the SEC's decision to back off regulations and enforcement in the financial services industry and in cryptocurrencies. Max Pringle reports. Chairman Atkins began his remarks by talking about the need to do away with what he called overly burdensome filing reports and other types of industry oversight that he said make it hard for the financial industry to serve its customers.
For example, public companies spend $2.7 billion a year to file their annual reports. This is $2.7 billion that companies are not reinvesting in their businesses to create jobs. It's $2.7 billion that our disclosure regime is diverting from your constituents to corporate lawyers, accountants, and consultants.
Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said the SEC under Atkins and Trump has become a breeding ground for fraud and corruption.
Markets without rules mean that the wealthy and the powerful take all the gains, while small businesses and workers and consumers get cheated. The SEC's job is to make sure that our markets are fair and honest. But nearly a year into running the agency, Chair Atkins is unleashing a golden age of fraud.
Warren laid out a few examples.
Over the past year, the SEC collected less in monetary penalties against bad actors than it has in over a decade. And I don't think anyone can say with a straight face that's because corporate CEOs are suddenly behaving better.
Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island said the SEC under Chairman Paul Atkins has seen its enforcement resources gutted. He put that question to Chairman Atkins.
But we had people retire by definition. That means that they had been there for a while. So this provides opportunity for younger people
to
rise up.
They retired because DOGE was running through SEC like every other agency.
I disagree.
Well,
that they, DOGE and SEC,
why would people
from what I understand, were focused.
Why would people at the prime of their careers retire? Because I think they felt that the direction they were going was something they did not want to participate in, which is sitting around as Americans are exploited and as the markets decline.
Democrats at the Senate banking hearing and at a House hearing with Atkins earlier this week brought up the SEC's near-total abandonment of crypto enforcement under Trump and whether it had anything to do with the president's business interests there. SEC Chairman Paul Atkins told the committee that he couldn't discuss individual cases, but he expressed his willingness to have further conversations in a confidential briefing. The SEC last year dropped high-profile enforcement matters against Binance, Ripple, Coinbase, Kraken, Robinhood, and several other crypto companies, with its new management criticizing what it called the regulation by enforcement approach to crypto under the agency's previous leadership. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson said today that he did not think it was appropriate for the Justice Department to be tracking the search history of lawmakers who are reviewing files from the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. The rare rebuke to the Trump administration came as photographs emerged revealing an apparent catalog of records reviewed by a Democratic member of Congress who was among a group of lawmakers given an opportunity to read less redacted versions of the Epstein files at a department annex on the department-owned computers. The Justice Department said in a statement that as part of the process of permitting lawmakers to review the Epstein files, it, quote, logs all searches made on its systems to protect against the release of victim information. Gallup will end nearly, Gallup will end nearly 9 decades of tracking presidential approval ratings, a spokesperson confirmed Wednesday, saying the move reflects the polling company's evolving research priorities. The decision ends a measure in use since Harry Truman's presidency, which has chronicled U.S. political history, including George W. Bush's 90% approval rating after 9/11. Gallup said it will continue other research initiatives, including the Gallup Poll Social Series, World Poll, and U.S. and Global Studies. The announcement comes as former President Donald Trump has publicly criticized polls showing low approval ratings, including Gallup's December 2025 report of 36% down from 47% at the start of his second term. Trump has threatened lawsuits against media outlets and polling firms he says misrepresent him, though outlets like the New York Times defend their methodology. Gallup said the change is, quote, solely based on Gallup's research goals and priorities and not any external pressure. Meanwhile, a new AP NORC poll finds that about 6 in 10 American adults believe that President Donald Trump has, quote, gone too far in sending federal immigration agents into U.S. cities. The survey also shows that the Republican Party's political advantage on Trump's signature domestic issue has shrunk since October. The new polling comes as the nation watches the human impact of Trump's immigration crackdown in Minnesota, where thousands of heavily armed masked agents have descended upon the capital city. About 9 in 10 Democrats and about 7 in 10 independents say Trump has gone too far in sending federal immigration agents into U.S. cities, compared to only about one quarter of Republicans. The Trump administration today revoked a 2009 scientific finding that has served as the legal backbone of nearly all federal climate regulations, a sweeping move that could unravel limits on greenhouse gas emissions from cars, power plants, and major industries. Lee Zeldin, Trump's administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, called the change a win for Americans.
This is a big deal. Under President Trump's leadership today, the Trump EPA has finalized the single largest act of deregulation in the history of the United States of America. Referred to by some as the holy grail of federal regulatory overreach, the 2009 Obama EPA endangerment finding is now eliminated.
The EPA rescinded the so-called endangerment finding, adopted during former President Barack Obama's administration, which concluded that carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases endanger public health and welfare. The finding followed the Supreme Court's 2007 ruling in Massachusetts versus EPA that greenhouse gases qualify as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. Since taking effect in 2010, the finding has underpinned emission standards for passenger vehicles, heavy-duty trucks, power plants, oil and gas facilities, and even certain aircraft. Its repeal eliminates greenhouse gas limits for cars and trucks and could open the door to dismantling regulations for stationary sources such as coal and gas-fired power plants and refineries. Zeldin said the finding has been holding American industries back.
Don't worry about it because it is not.
The endangerment finding is hereby eliminated, as well as all greenhouse gas emission standards that followed. The red tape has been cut. Manufacturers will no longer be burdened by measuring, compiling, or reporting greenhouse gas emissions for vehicles and engines.
In response to the announcement, Abigail Dillon, president of the environmental advocacy law group Earth Justice, said in a statement, quote, "The Trump administration is sacrificing our health, our safety, our economy, and our future by abandoning its core responsibility to keep us safe from extreme weather and accelerating climate change." The courts have repeatedly affirmed EPA's obligation to clean up climate pollution. There is no way to reconcile EPA's decision with the law, the science, and the reality of disasters that are hitting us harder every year. But President Trump dismissed concerns that revoking the finding could lead to long-term negative health consequences for Americans.
Don't worry about it because it has nothing to do with public health. This was all a scam, a giant scam. This was a ripoff of the country by Obama and Biden. And let's say Obama started it and got it rolling. And a terrible ripoff. They'll have more money to spend for health care, if you look at it. Now they can go out and spend it on something that's meaningful.
Environmental groups said overturning the finding would undermine decades of scientific research linking rising global temperatures to more intense and dangerous extreme weather. David Doniger, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, called the Trump administration's stance on climate change a political denial that ignored the real-world situation.
As one scientist said today, you can repeal the endangerment finding, but you can't repeal the endangerment. The problem of climate change is real. People can see it outside their doors. Every time we have extreme weather like fires or floods or storms or droughts and heat waves, and the current forces that want to go back to coal, oil, and gas and stick us back into the 19th century will not win.
Experts also said rescinding the finding could complicate future administrations' ability to regulate climate pollution, forcing them to restart a lengthy scientific and legal process likely to face years of court battles. Legal challenges against the rule change are expected. Doniger said he was optimistic that a lawsuit against the change would be successful and noted that federal courts have repeatedly upheld the finding.
The Supreme Court didn't just decide this in 2007. There have been three subsequent Supreme Court decisions on climate-changing pollution and the Clean Air Act. And in every one of those, the court has followed its precedent. The last one was in 2022 with the current makeup of the court. And so we're not just dealing with a decision by the court of the past. We're dealing with one that's being followed, has been followed by the court of the present.
A year after a major measles outbreak in Texas, the contagious disease continues to spread across the country and elsewhere in North and South America. While the Trump administration's health secretary has cast doubt on vaccines, another top health official is now urging people to take the vaccine, please. Christopher Martinez reports.
Cases of measles are on the rise across the Americas, and the United States is far from immune. In fact, a measles outbreak in South Carolina has hit the milestone of being the largest outbreak in the country in more than a quarter century, with 920 cases. South Carolina state epidemiologist Dr. Linda Bell told reporters 19 people have been hospitalized, with some suffering from measles-related encephalitis, a brain swelling linked to severe outcomes. Local residents told Associated Press they feel concerned, but not panicked. Sharon Grillo is a resident of Inman.
I know that I was vaccinated. I know my daughter and my little granddaughter were. My concern is my husband doesn't remember, and he's older, and that's a concern. I'm not panicked. I feel that people in my age group, we were all vaccinated. I'm not going to lose sleep over it, but yes, I have some mild concern.
South Carolina's outbreak is larger than last year's largest outbreak in West Texas. Arizona and Utah are also experiencing major outbreaks. In fourth place, Florida, at least 20 students have confirmed measles infections at Ave Maria University, while a second measles case has been linked to exposure at Disneyland. And in Washington, D.C., people who attended last month's National March for Life rally may have been exposed, and people with confirmed cases are said to have visited locations including Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport and the D.C. subway system. International health authorities say they plan to meet in April to determine whether the U.S. has lost its measles-free designation. But the principal deputy director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Ralph Abraham, said last week that he would consider the loss of elimination status to be the cost of doing business globally. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and other administration health officials have sown doubt about the established safety of vaccines. But the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Dr. Mehmet Oz, has a clear message. He was interviewed Sunday on CNN's State of the Union.
Take the vaccine, please. We have a solution for a problem. Not all illnesses are equally dangerous and not all people are equally susceptible to those illnesses. But measles is one you should get your vaccine.
The Pan-American Health Organization issued an alert last week about the surge in measles across the Americas. Last November, Canada lost its measles-free status, and the U.S. and Mexico are on track to follow soon. Both the U.S. and Mexico have requested a two-month extension to contain their outbreaks. But for the U.S., the situation is complicated by the recent withdrawal of the U.S. from the World Health Organization, the parent agency of the Pan-American Organization. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is refusing to consider drug maker Moderna's application for a new flu vaccine made with the mRNA technology. The company announced the news on this week. The FDA's decision reflects heightened scrutiny under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has criticized mRNA technology. Moderna received a refuse-to-file letter objecting to its clinical trial methods. The FDA said the trial didn't compare the new shot to the best available standards of care. Moderna has requested an urgent meeting with the FDA and noted it has applied for approval in Europe, Canada, and Australia. We'll be back with more news after this.
Hi, this is Stanley Clark. KPFK is the radio powered by the people. Without that people power, KPFK could not exist as a truly independent source of information and inspiration. So please pledge your financial support during these challenging and turbulent times. The number to call is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK or pledge online anytime at www.kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're tuned to 90.7 FM KPFK, radio powered by the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace!
A federal judge today ordered the Trump administration to make arrangements for some Venezuelan migrants deported to a notorious prison in El Salvador to return to the U.S. at the government's expense. U.S. District Judge James Baseberg said officials must provide boarding letters and cover airfare for men now in third countries who want to challenge their removals. Those returning would be detained, and migrants remaining in Venezuela could also file new legal documents, arguing that the presidential proclamation under which they were deported illegally invoked the 18th century Alien Enemies Act or wrongly labeled them as gang members. The case began in March of last year after Trump officials sent 137 Venezuelan men to the El Salvadoran Terrorism Confinement Center, or CECOT, despite a verbal order from Baseberg to halt the deportations. The men were later returned to Venezuela in a prisoner exchange. Attorney Lee Gellert, who represents the Venezuelan prisoners, said the court's order begins the process of allowing the men to challenge their removals. Baseberg criticized the government for failing to act without a court mandate, writing that otherwise the administration could, quote, simply remove people from the United States without providing any process. Administration lawyers have vowed to appeal the ruling. A U.S. judge says President Donald Trump's $10 billion lawsuit against the BBC can go to trial in 2027. Judge Roy Altman of the Federal Court for Southern District of Florida rejected an attempt by Britain's national broadcaster to delay proceedings. He set a February 2027 trial date. Trump filed a lawsuit in December of last year over the way the BBC edited a speech he gave on January 6 of 2021. The claim seeks $5 billion in damages for defamation and another $5 billion for unfair trade practices. The broadcaster has apologized to Trump over the edit of the speech, but the publicly funded BBC rejects claims it defamed him. Russia attacked Ukrainian cities again overnight as Ukraine accused Russia of dragging its feet on new U.S.-brokered peace talks. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Washington is proposing talks next week in Miami or in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. He said Ukraine confirmed it can attend, but Russia is hesitating. Zelensky said major disputes still block a deal, including issues of occupied land and security guarantees. He also said Russia is ignoring a proposed ceasefire that impacts the energy sector. Ukraine's Air Force said today that Russia fired drones and missiles at Kyiv, Kharkiv, Dnipro, and Odessa. Officials reported injuries, damaged homes, and major heating outages in the Ukrainian capital. Meanwhile, Ukrainian Olympic skeleton racer Vyacheslav Hereskevich was barred from competing at the Winter Olympics in Milan because his helmet paid tribute to athletes and coaches killed in Russia's war on Ukraine. Donna Warder reports.
Olympic Committee spokesperson Mark Adams says the IOC wants Hereskevich to have his moment, and it feels his grief over the war in Ukraine.
There are 130 conflicts going on in the world. We cannot have 130 different conflicts featured, however terrible they are. We cannot have them featured during the field of play, during the actual competition.
Hereskevich says the IOC's decision plays along with Russian propaganda.
What is meaning of expression, so or smile or something else, or some pictures on a helmet, what had all athletes, almost all athletes in our field, also considered as an expression. And yeah, to be honest, I cannot understand for what I was suspended, and I still try to figure out.
Hereskevich was among the fastest in training leading into the Olympic races. I'm Donna Warder.
President Donald Trump said nothing definitive came from his meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. The two leaders met at the White House to discuss Iran's nuclear program and other issues. Tony Waterman reports.
In a social media post after the meeting, President Trump said he insisted to Netanyahu that negotiations with Iran will continue to see if a deal can be reached, and that nothing definitive had come from his talks with the Israeli prime minister. Netanyahu had moved forward a trip to Washington to try and convince President Trump to expand the scope of negotiations with Iran to include not only its nuclear program, but also its ballistic missile program. Israel sees both as a threat to its very existence. Trump reiterated his desire for a deal, but implied he'd be willing to take more military action against Iran if that didn't happen. Tony Waterman, Washington.
Mexico has sent two Navy ships with humanitarian aid to Cuba as tighter U.S. pressure worsens the island's energy crisis. The ships that arrived today carried large loads of food, hygiene supplies, and powdered milk. Mexico says one ship brought about 536 tons of items like rice, beans, canned fish, and oil. Mexico said the second ship carried over 277 tons of powdered milk. President Claudia Sheinbaum said Mexico is providing aid while talks continue on oil supplies. U.S. President Donald Trump had oil to Cuba. Cuba relied heavily on oil shipments from Venezuela that were halted when the U.S. attacked the South American country in early January and arrested its leader. Cuba has also reduced bank hours and suspended cultural events, while fuel distribution companies have said that sales only will be made in dollars and limited to 20 liters per user. That's a little over 5 gallons. In addition to severe blackouts, Cuban officials say that U.S. sanctions, which increased under Trump's second term, cost the country more than $7.5 billion between March of 2024 and February of 2025. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell last week, remaining within a historically healthy range. The Labor Department reported today that jobless claims for the week ending February 7th declined by 5,000 to 227,000, roughly in line with economists' expectations. Weekly applications are seen as a proxy for layoffs. The four-week moving average, which smooths out volatility, rose by 7,000 to 219,000. Continuing claims for the week ending in January 31st increased by 21,000 to about 1.86 million. The report follows data showing employers added 130,000 jobs in January and the unemployment rate dipped to 4.3%. Still, recent revisions sharply reduced last year's job gains, and job openings have fallen to their lowest level in more than 5 years. Layoffs remain relatively low, though companies including UPS and Amazon have announced cuts. Economists remain divided over whether hiring is stabilizing or continuing to slow. More than a year after the Eaton fire, which killed 19 and destroyed more than 9,000 structures in Los Angeles County in January of 2025, California Attorney General Rob Bonta announced a civil rights investigation of the response to the wildfire.
The California Department of Justice, led by our Civil Rights Enforcement Section, has launched an independent investigation into the emergency response to the Eaton fire and the disproportionately devastating impact it had on the historically Black neighborhood of West Altadena.
A series of LA Times investigations found that West Altadena faced disproportionate damages as a result of the fire. West Altadena residents received late evacuation alerts and fewer firefighting resources than neighboring communities, like the wider, more affluent East Altadena. The LA Times found that West Altadena residents did not get electronic evacuation orders until 3:30 in the morning on January 8th, hours after the fire had started and engulfed the area, and at least 6 hours later than East Altadena residents began getting alerts.
There are concerning circumstances surrounding the Eaton fire that have raised questions, making this investigation necessary. The biggest of which is that there was indisputably a delayed emergency notification and evacuation of West Altadena. We're here to ask why.
Bonta said 18 of the 19 victims of the Eaton fire lived in West Altadena. This includes Stacy Darden, whose family filed a wrongful death suit, saying she died as a result of the delayed evacuation alert. Family's lawsuit alleges the software Los Angeles County uses for emergency alerts was defective and failed to alert Darden to leave in time. Bonta said his office's investigation is driven by one overarching question.
Did the Los Angeles County Fire Department's delay in notifying and evacuating the historically Black West Altadena community during the Eaton fire violate state anti-discrimination and disability rights laws?
Bonta said that after the investigation is completing, the findings will be shared with the public.
There will be a public announcement of the results of this investigation. When that will be, don't know. What those results will be, no idea. That's why we're doing the investigation. But there will be a public component at some point.
San Francisco supervisors are questioning PG&E following a series of widespread power outages that left tens of thousands of residents and businesses in the dark. The oversight hearing comes after a December outage that impacted more than a third of the city, disrupting homes, stranding seniors, and costing small businesses thousands of dollars. KBFA's health and well-being reporters Annetta Felix brings us details from today's hearing at City Hall.
San Francisco supervisors pressed PG&E executives Thursday about communication failures during last December's massive power outage. Supervisor Alan Wong posed a question about the outage.
Your presentation said communications were timely and consistent, but merchants told us the outage map, text, and the call center often contradicted each other. Which one should the public treat as the source of truth?
On Saturday, December 20th, 2025, a major fire at the PG&E Mission substation triggered a massive power failure that affected about 130,000 customers, nearly one-third of San Francisco. The outage occurred during the peak of the holiday shopping season, paralyzing transit lines, closing BART stations, and forcing thousands of small businesses to shutter during the busiest weekend of the year. While 75% of those impacted were restored within the first day, thousands of residents in the Richmond and Sunset districts endured a total blackout lasting over 66 hours, with full restoration not occurring until the following Tuesday. In response, PG&E committed $50 million towards automatic bill credits of $200 for residential customers and $2,500 for businesses, while processing additional claims for individual losses. The supervisor's hearing is about counting the cost of that outage and charting the way forward. PG&E CEO Sumit Singh takes responsibility.
In terms of the accountability, that accountability rests with me, starts with me.
in terms of ensuring that the communications we're providing are accurate. And obviously, we take that accountability very seriously. And I speak on behalf of our 29,000 PG&E co-workers and family members.
The power outage costs small businesses thousands of dollars, like Sean Kim, co-owner of Joe's Ice Cream and vice president of Gary Merchants Association.
My freezer shut down, and then when the freezer shut down, the ice cream melt like this. And then when ice cream melt, we lose all the inventory, not only for that day, for the whole week immediately. And there's no recovery, it's gone. And there's not just product on the shelf, you know, there's weeks of preparation and inventories, labors, and revenues that disappears in hours.
Singh emphasized that PG&E provided financial relief to affected customers, offering credits and support to help offset the losses caused by the prolonged outage.
So far, we've received 2,750 claims. That includes residential and non-residential. And as of yesterday, we have resolved nearly 90% of those claims. And we've been able to do that in 15 days or less on average, which is about half the time from a claims processing perspective.
Supervisors raised concerns about inconsistent information across PG&E alert systems, with outage maps showing incorrect data. Customers also struggled to reach help during the crisis.
During the event, we experienced higher than normal call volume. And so for those 3 or 4 days during the event, we were looking at around 20,000 calls that were coming into the contact center specifically related to this event. On average, obviously you'll see some higher than that, some lower than that. And so that goes beyond our standard as well. And so one of the lessons learned from that, obviously, is that in the event of an emergency like this, we have to reconfigure our staffing plan, get folks on those calls faster, and also ensure that we have in-language support lined up for those types of calls.
Another major point of contention was language access during the outage.
The primary language that was used was English, and as I mentioned, you know, that's another improvement in regards to ensuring we're providing, you know, multiple languages and in languages on things like Cantonese, Mandarin, depending upon the preferences that our customers are opting in and selecting on their language of preference for notification and communication. So that is an action that's already been taken on our part.
Supervisors also discussed long-standing debates over public power, including whether city ownership of the electric system could improve reliability. Reporting for KPFA Radio, I'm Annetta Felix.
Today marked the fourth day of a strike by San Francisco public school teachers, with schools across the district remaining closed. Negotiations have reportedly bogged down over the main issues of wages, special education, and classroom sizes. Superintendent Maria Sue said that district staff and Mayor Daniel Lurie, who joined the union and the district at the bargaining table on Tuesday evening, expected to stay at the table, quote, all night until a deal was made. Sue criticized the union for leaving late Tuesday before its members could review the district's counterproposal. The district has offered a 10% wage increase for classified employees like paraeducators who are not teacher certified. The union had sought 14%. Meanwhile, the West Contra Costa Unified School District Board yesterday unanimously approved a $42 million budget cut plan for the 2026 to 2027 school year, including a 10% reduction in staffing and the closure or consolidation of some schools. The district, serving 25,000 students in the Bay Area, held multiple community meetings before the vote and made small amendments, allowing elementary schools to retain parent engagement workers, known as SCALs. Leaders said staffing cuts will come largely through retirements, resignations, and unfilled positions, with state law requiring notice to employees by March 15th. The cuts follow the district's first teachers' strike, settled in December with wage and benefits increases. Board member Demetrio Gonzalez-Hoy called the plan, quote, incredibly difficult, but necessary to avoid state receivership. Parents and staff rallied to keep Betty Reed Soskin Middle School open, but the board voted to merge it with nearby Pinole Middle School, promising to honor Soskin's legacy in other ways.
This is Maggie LaPique.
And I'm Gary Baca for KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
During our winter fund drive, we are honoring Black History Month by celebrating the voices that have historically challenged power and demanded justice. From the roots of civil rights to the contemporary fight for liberation, KPFK remains dedicated to amplifying Black brilliance and resistance. But we can't do this work without your support. Your donation keeps independent, community-funded media alive. Please make a donation today at kpfk.org/donate or call us right now, 818-985-5735, press option 2. Support Black history, support independent media, support KPFK.
Our winter fund drive continues until March 6. Join KPFK 90.7 FM for our winter fund drive. As a listener-supported platform, we remain one of the few places on the dial where the airwaves belong to the people, not corporations. In honor of Black History Month centennial, we are featuring the profound insights and historical recordings of the giants who shook the foundations of injustice, including James Baldwin, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Dr. Cornel West, and so many others from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Your contribution keeps our independent voice alive and preserves these revolutionary voices for the next generation. The number to call is 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online anytime at kpfk.org/donate. Donate today and let your voice be heard. Today, in 2026, we mark a full century of this vital work. What began as a week of learning in segregated schoolhouses has grown into a global month-long celebration of brilliance and resilience.
The 2026 centennial theme is a century of Black history commemorations, reflecting on how these moments have shaped our national identity. This collection features historic programming from all five Pacifica sister stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, and Pacifica National Specials, celebrating 100 years of Black History Month. Black History Month Centennial Collection comes as an 8-gigabyte jump drive, or we can email downloadable files. That's a $150 donation. Put that on your Visa, MasterCard, American Express. Call now, 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online at kpfk.org/donate. Our flagship collection is the Black History Month Centennial Collection. 72 programs, 85 hours from all five Pacifica stations, and you hear the voices, as Gary said, of Malcolm X, Angela Davis, James Baldwin, Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, Black history and the voices of the people who made it. Gary, let's take a listen to an excerpt from a talk from James Baldwin, Harlem, 1963. He's standing in a room full of people 3 months before the March on Washington. And he's about to rewrite the founding myth of this country in just about 2 minutes. Listen to who he says really built America.
Before this country was established, when the country was being established, and this, apart from what one's textbooks say, and in contradistinction to the television myths about the building, the discovery of America, the people who came to America, as it turns out, were neither heroes, saints, nor pilgrims. They were simply people who couldn't make it where they were. And that is why they came. They came here to make, as we like to say, a better life for themselves and their children. And as it turned out, and as it always does indeed turn out, what they meant by a better life for themselves and their children was the opportunity to make more money and oppress somebody else. Which is what they did. The Indians have vanished, except for those we have under protective custody. And in order to build the country, it was necessary to find a source of cheap labor. And therefore, 400 years later, I represent the only man who never wanted to come here.
James Baldwin, 1963.
A part of your Black History Month centennial collection.
That recording has been in the Pacifica Vault for 60 years. The Black History Month Centennial Collection has 72 recordings like that. 85 hours, voices you cannot hear anywhere else. It's a $150 pledge to KPFK or $25 a month. Call us now, 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online, kpfk.org/donate. To secure the future of independent, community-powered radio at KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, we are celebrating 100 years of intentional Black History commemorations, a movement that began as Negro History Week in February 1926 and has grown into a global observation. A century of Black History commemorations focusing on the historical origins, evolution, and enduring significance of these remembrances. As part of the Pacifica Foundation, KPFK remains one of the few platforms dedicated to the unseen and unheard stories of the Black diaspora. From local grassroots activism to global cultural impact, we need to remind you that KPFK provides accurate, inclusive history at a time when curriculum debates and book bans are challenging the preservation of African American narratives. Please help us fund the station's winter operations to ensure these vital programs continue through the spring.
Hey, Maggie, so KPFK is powered by the people. That's you. Call now, 818-985-5735, or pledge securely online at kpfk.org/donate. We encourage listeners to become sustainers to provide a stable foundation for the station's future for as little as $5 a month. How about $10, $15, $20, $25 per month? Also donate online anytime at kpfk.org/donate or call in 818-985-5735, option 2.
We need you, folks. This is People Powered. That means you. Call us right now, 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online, kpfk.org/donate. Thank you so much.
February, we're sending a love letter to our listeners, and we're asking for one in return. KPFK exists because of the passion and the hearts of people like you. We don't have corporate sponsors. We have you. Keep the romance with independent media alive by making a donation today. Call 818-985-5735, option 2, or visit kpfk.org/donate. Give a gift from the heart and keep grassroots independent radio strong.
All I know is I love you for so many reasons.
I am not like them.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Attaka Quartet and Teo Bleckman on Saturday, February 28th at the Nimoy. The artist unites to perform Pulitzer Prize winner David Lang's Note to a Friend, a 60-minute chamber opera that addresses our eternal human fascinations with death, love, and family. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
I love KPFK. I've been listening to it for probably 20 years, and it blows me away, all the different shows and all the DJs. and they're introducing me to new music all the time, and every now and then I'll hear something I know, you know, and it's the best radio station because you can hear every kind of music on it, and